You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrick. Coming up, we talk to an economist about what the state's low unemployment rate means for businesses looking to hire. First, it's time for our weekly roundup of state news. More details are being released about the death of a Milwaukee police officer, the second officer death for the department in the last 2 months. And Governor Walker is proposing a new tuition freeze for UW schools if he's reelected. Robert Menser joins us now for a look at those stories and more. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Why, thank you.
I want to start with a look at the story in Milwaukee. They lost a police officer in the line of duty, 52-year-old Michael Michalski. Here's Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett recounting what he's been told about Officer Michalski.
They said he embodied the professionalism and the respect that we all want to see throughout our police department. That he was the one that oftentimes was sent into the most difficult situations because of his ability to communicate with people, because of the level of respect that he showed individuals regardless of where they stood in the community.
So, Rob, what are we finding out about the circumstances that led to his death?
Sure. So this is a tough story, and it's been one of the biggest stories to follow this week. So Michalski was part of a Special Investigations Division, which is a new unit in the Milwaukee Police Department that is really designed to go after repeat offenders, violent criminals, people who are a threat to public safety. They were pursuing a man who was a convicted felon who had warrants out for drug offenses and domestic violence. They found him. He ran inside a house, and officers tried to follow him. And then police say that the man started firing on them, and one of those shots killed Michalski.
And this isn't the only loss the Milwaukee Police Department is dealing with in the last couple of months, right?
Right. Yeah. Not even 2 months ago, an officer was killed in a car crash as he was pursuing a reckless driver, and that was the department's department's first death in the line of duty in 22 years. So to have two in a summer is devastating.
And we heard a bit from Mayor Barrett earlier, but how is Michalski being remembered?
Sure. So Michalski was 52. He had been with the Milwaukee Police Department for 17 years. He was married and had three sons. This is a time of memorials, but he really seems to have been really sincere in his as a public servant in trying to make the community of Milwaukee better. There's a new report that just posted like within the last 15 minutes by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the role that Michalski's faith played in his life and his work as a police officer, and I would recommend it. It's pretty powerful stuff.
Move on to another story now, Rob. This issue of a tuition freeze, it's been ongoing at UW campuses for some years now. It's an election issue now. Governor Walker said this week that if reelected, he would want to extend the tuition freeze currently in place for UW campuses for another 4 years. Can you put this in some context for us?
Right. So, I guess politically, from Walker's perspective, this is sort of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But if he were reelected and the tuition freeze were extended for 4 more years, that would be a 10-year-long tuition freeze. That is a long time for the University of Wisconsin system. Of course, like the UW administrator's point is that if there is inflation happening in the world, then every year they're not allowed to increase tuition is effectively a cut in their funding, happening at the same time that funding may be cut by state government. So they see that as a hardship. But for people who have to pay tuition, I think it's more of a more politically popular policy.
And Democratic candidates for governor have been responding. There are 8 of them. But what are some of the main things you've been hearing from them?
Well, I sort of jumped into the politics straight away, right? But this is why you see Democratic politicians who many of the leading candidates are also in favor of a tuition freeze, and some are in favor of cutting UW tuitions. Their perspective tends to be that the state ought to stop cutting funds to the UW system. But there's like no politician who wants to say that the cost should increase to families who pay tuition.
Right. But the argument then is over not that tuition revenue for the university system, but general purpose revenue, the state budget, and the portion of that that goes to higher education. That might be a point of debate in the months to come.
Right, exactly. So, and you know, university funding is complicated. Tuition is a slice, and state funding is a slice. And like, there's donations. There's the universities have these large budgets. So there is room for debate on what is the exact right share of all those things. But it does feel like, I mean, a tuition freeze on some level, it is the I think everyone who's sort of studies this as a policy matter says that it's a superficial issue. It's a way that to get political attention, but it does not address underlying issues about, you know, what you want the UW to be.
Talking about some of the top Wisconsin news stories of the week with Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin. Rob, Josh Hader, Milwaukee Brewers relief pitcher, has made his first couple of appearances on the mound after some controversy over tweets he'd made in his teen years with racist, sexist, and homophobic elements to them. Bring us up to date on the story.
Yeah, I mean, the tweets were bad. These were bad tweets, Rob. This came out sort of during the All-Star game. Somebody, maybe because of the sort of a higher profile of that national spotlight, but somebody dug through these old tweets that he had posted when he was 17, like 2011, 2012, and there was a bunch of offensive stuff. He actually wrote, "I hate gay people." He tweeted KKK at one point. It's like not great. So the Major League Baseball has ordered him to take sensitivity training. He came out with an apology that really seemed like an actual apology. Like it was not one of these "I'm sorry if you were offended" kind of things. He said he was sorry, and he doesn't hold those views, and there's no excuse for what he wrote. So he came out and pitched in Milwaukee and got a big standing ovation from the crowd, which became sort of a point of controversy in itself.
Right. What kind of reactions have people had since he's been back on the mound now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the fact that he was 17 is not, you know, that is material to this, right? The fact that his apology is a real apology is material to it, and yet still there was some folks who felt like, essentially by sort of, you know, I don't know, rising, giving a standing ovation to the guy, that that it was a little too soon, you know. They're sort of saying like it's no big deal to make these offensive statements. Also, should be said, a little sports tribalism is at play here. He was booed when he appeared not in Milwaukee. So I think your opinion about the seriousness of Josh Hader's offenses here may be partly colored by whether or not it's in your interest to root for the Milwaukee Brewers.
And another sports-related story before we wrap up, Rob. It's been a long wait. Yesterday, we found out about the naming rights for the new Milwaukee Bucks Arena opening this year. Who ended up getting those naming rights?
Fiserv, Rob. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know naming rights are like part of life. I have no specific beef with this financial services company, but man, Fiserv Forum, that is a boring name. Am I right?
I will not weigh in on that, Rob, but it's not the most exciting venue name we've ever seen. And this company, Fiserv, it's kind of a behind-the-scenes company, right? They do stuff that is kind of back-end stuff for credit unions and banks. It's not something that consumers are generally going to be familiar with.
Right, or haven't been up until now, but now they got their name on this this fancy new stadium and arena. So I guess they're gonna jump to the front of people's minds.
And Rob, we'd had a little office pool with no money on the line going, and you got into it. You had guessed Johnsonville. Other ideas out there were American Family, Johnson Controls, and Manpower. All of us wrong.
Boy, yeah, no one reached for
Fiserv.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there, Rob. And, you know, naming rights for Central Time, Rob, if you're interested, you can bid. This is Rob Mentzer, Central Time? Yeah, maybe.
Rob Mentzer, Central Time? All right, well, I'll talk to your people.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Rob.
All right, thank you.
It's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Wisconsin has been at or near record low unemployment numbers for months, and that presents some challenges to businesses in the state who are looking to hire. For a lot of employers, trying to find qualified workers in the state's labor crunch is becoming increasingly difficult. Jim McGibney is an associate professor of economics at Marquette University. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, these unemployment rates have been pretty low for a while now. Is this actually affecting people at the business level? Is it making it harder for them to fill those positions?
Yes, it's, you know, the Wisconsin unemployment rate is about 2.9% now in the last monthly survey, and it's been dropping steadily since, you know, 2010. And especially in certain industries, for a variety of different reasons, firms are having trouble finding qualified workers now that the economy is expanding and is expanding a little bit more rapidly than it has in the past.
What kind of industries are really feeling the pinch here?
Well, one of the main ones has to do with manufacturing, and that partly because of the reaction of what happened, you know, starting in this century. You know, we went from, in the United States, about 17 million manufacturing workers in 2000 to about 11.5 million in 2010. So that drop of about 5.5 million workers, you know, just got people off the thought process of that was going to be a good career. And so now when the economy is expanding, and one of the reasons that we're expanding is business investment has been pretty high, so that adds to manufacturing demand. It's tough to get those workers because we haven't been training them at the rate we need to.
So are we playing catch-up? And, you know, is this a problem where, okay, we start training manufacturing workers today, and who knows, maybe there's a recession in the 2 or 4 years or whatever it takes to get them trained up?
Oh, that's been it's happening. I mean, the manufacturing employment has been going up fairly steadily since at least 2013. So it looks like it's got to have some momentum there. I mean, you know, we can talk about the tariffs and the trade situation, how that might affect things. And manufacturing's always been a cyclical industry, so that's always going to be a problem. But it looks like, you know, we've got some momentum going, and trying to get those people in place now and in the near future is a good thing if we can get them trained.
Is this a case where the problem's going to solve itself? There's a labor shortage, so businesses start paying more and maybe lowering their standards, doing more training on their own, and voila, we'll be fine?
Well, again, that's happened a little bit. You know, one of the problems with, you would think, right, the economics tells you, you know, we have extra demand. That should push the price up. Here we have extra demand for workers. Why isn't that pushing the wage rate up? Well, it really hasn't that much, even though we've had this extra demand for workers. And one of the reasons why is that, well, that adds to the cost of the business. So how can they kind of recoup that? Let's try to raise our prices. Well, firms have had a tough time adding pricing power. So just until recently, you know, the inflation rate's been pretty low. You know, it's been a little bit higher now. So maybe now we'll start seeing a little bit more of, you know, trying to entice workers with higher wages and so on.
That makes me think of the agricultural sector, where if they're having to pay more to get workers, well, they can't set their prices at all. If they're selling, say, on the milk commodity market or other commodity markets, the prices are basically set beyond their control. Is this a real pinch for the agricultural sector?
Well, it's a pinch for a lot of different sectors. Agriculture is a great one because there's so much competition. Like you said, they really don't have pricing power. They basically have to say, you know, here's what the price of a bushel of wheat is, or bushel of corn, whatever the case might be, or milk or whatever. And so they have no pricing power. So they really are in a tough bind when their costs go up. And so they are also looking for workers. Again, another thing, you know, we've kind of pushed people into the 4-year college situation, and agricultural and manufacturing, and that's not that great of a career. So those are industries that are having a tough time finding workers and trying to pay them more to attract more people.
Jim McGibney is with us from Marquette University. He's an associate professor of economics there. We're looking at the impact of low unemployment numbers on Wisconsin employers as they try to fill jobs. Jim, I want to talk about the labor force participation rate. Part of how we measure unemployment leaves some people out there. Some people have given up looking for jobs or for various reasons aren't in the labor force. Have we seen movement on that in recent years in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, what's happened has been a long-term trend of, you know, lower labor force participation throughout a whole bunch of different demographics, especially men. It just kind of started with women. Obviously, the recession of 2008-09-10 kind of spurred that on a little bit more. So just recently, labor force participation has kind of upticked, but it's still at a fairly low rate compared to what it has been in the last 10 or 20 years.
Would there be a match between people who are in that situation not currently looking for work and the positions we need? Is that a potential source to fill, say, those manufacturing jobs?
Likely not, because you know they're not. If they were out of the labor force in the last 3 or 4 years when the uptick in manufacturing employment was happening, you would think that they would have been back in the labor force already. So it's probably unlikely that the people that are out there that are just kind of starting to get back into the labor force would have the necessary skills. They might be like general labor and, you know, sort of relatively low-skilled workers, but probably not those highly qualified manufacturing, you know, something that can be a welder or a press operator or whatever the case might be.
We've been talking Wisconsin-wide so far, but are there regions of the state, particular cities or areas that are really feeling a labor crunch?
It's always been the case for many years that, you know, Madison, because of the state government and because of the university there, has always had a very, very low unemployment rate relative to the rest of the state. That's true not only for Wisconsin, but other states that have a state capital and a flagship university in the same city. So that would be one. So regions around Madison would be one. So the suburban regions of Milwaukee have had relatively low unemployment rates. Unlike, you know, Racine's a little bit higher unemployment, so they've got some maybe a little bit of slack in their labor market.
Is there a regional gap? Are there places that have relatively higher unemployment in the state near places with jobs, and for some reason we're not able to get those workers from one place to another?
Well, that's another problem with this, the lack of workers is, there might be some people, let's say, again, Racine's been an important, one of the bigger cities that has had a relatively higher unemployment rate than some of the surrounding ones. But if the jobs are open in La Crosse or Madison or Green Bay, you know, you've got to basically pick up your roots and move. And some people aren't ready to do that, maybe because, you know, family member A has got a job in that city, and family member B who's looking, you know, you want to split the family up. Those kind of things. So that's always been an issue. The same thing with, you know, inner city Milwaukee, especially a higher unemployment rate for, you know, persons of color has been the case, although that's been coming down also, but it's still higher than the state average. Again, how do you get those workers from that location to, let's say, Kohler up in Sheboygan because they've got some manufacturing jobs open?
Well, Jim, I got to ask, what happens if we say in southeastern Wisconsin break ground on a big new factory that's going to have a lot of job demands, like, say, Foxconn? How does that fit in here?
Well, one of the reasons, I'm sure it's not maybe the primary reason, but one of the reasons that they picked that area is because there was some, you know, higher skilled workers that have been in manufacturing in the past. In the Racine area, obviously, there was the Lake Michigan story also. But that's a positive thing. You know, I know Mayor Barrett is trying to get Amazon to move a potential, you know, distribution center from southern Milwaukee County to northern Milwaukee County inside the city of Milwaukee for that reason about having unemployment, more unemployment in the central city. You know, so if that can be done, that will help those areas, but it's going to be tough to find other workers who are in that sort of in the vicinity because we're having a shortage already.
So, Jim, are there state policies that could look long-term to try to have worker flexibility and mobility that could help address these problems in the future?
Well, the first one is, and I know we've been spending quite a bit of money in the last, especially the last 5 to 8, 10 years, on trying to push more people into the manufacturing industry, and let's say being auto mechanics and things like that, you know, working with their hands as opposed to through the four-year college thing. You know, and, I've benefited from that being a university professor, but, you know, we can definitely see this worker shortage. So more training and more kind of trying to get people at a younger age to work with their hands and do these manufacturing type jobs, that would be one thing. We've had some movement on trying to get people from places where there are some little bit of labor slack, let's say in central cities, out to the suburban rings or into a different part of the state, maybe, you know, a 100-mile trip. The problem with that is, again, it's this family thing. So are you going to be moving, something like that? The other, you know, now we're getting into a lot of different things. Like, is there enough housing at that level, at the sort of starter income level, available in places where they need workers? You know, it would be nice. Maybe somebody from a place where there's relatively high unemployment. Let's say we're going to move to a Madison or a Ring County of Milwaukee. Well, all the housing is too expensive, so they can't move. So those are some of the other things that can be done.
We'll leave it there for now. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
That's Jim McGibney, Associate Professor of Economics at Marquette University. He joined us to talk about the labor squeeze businesses are feeling with the state's unemployment rate under 3%. If you're an employer, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a note, email ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. What's going on with hiring where you are? The White House released a report this month that said, in essence, poverty in the United States has been mostly eliminated, in part thanks to a long-running federal war on poverty. It's a departure from previous Republican statements, such as those from House Speaker Paul Ryan. They've argued that the war on poverty hasn't yielded the results that were hoped for when President Lyndon Johnson made reducing poverty a priority back in 1964. The U.S. Census Bureau estimated that in 2016, more than 43 million Americans were living below the poverty line. It's nearly 13% of the U.S. population. The White House says the war on poverty is just about over. That could have a big impact on social programs like welfare and food assistance, and the impact on the poorest Americans could be significant. Our next guest is here to talk about the report, the future of social welfare programs, and poverty in Wisconsin. Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He was previously the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Well, let's go back to the start of this war on poverty. When President Johnson announced it was known unofficially as the war on poverty. What was happening in the United States at that time?
Well, at that time, Robert Lampman, actually, who was a famous professor from Wisconsin, had published a fraction of American families living with incomes below $3,000 a year. And there was a lot of reaction to it, and Johnson reacted to both Lampman's work and also to books like The Other America by Michael Harrington, and we decided that we should try and help those who are least well off in our country. Now, this is, you know, a while ago, and you could still make a good living in a blue-collar job. And we had a father breadwinner, mother stayed home with kids sort of economy. And we set up a poverty measure for then. You know, it's now almost 60 years later, and things have changed. So we need to think more about what it is we're doing. In my opinion, we haven't won the war on poverty. We've made some progress, particularly because of a lot of the programs that others want to cut. But we haven't won the war at all. Walk outside in downtown Madison, look at homeless people, go out to the north side, ask people in the food pantries, ask the nonprofits, talk to anybody who works, you know, even in a church dealing with people who are at least well off, a ministry for social welfare, and you will find that poverty is not gone.
I know people use different ways of measuring poverty. Can you get a sense of where we are in the country, in Wisconsin, and how it compares to, you know, when the war on poverty was kicked off?
Yes, I can. Well, every year we publish the Wisconsin Poverty Report, which is 10 years now. And we use a methodology similar to something called the Supplemental Poverty Measure that the federal government uses. And why this is important is because it accounts for programs like our food share program and the earned income credit and the way that they affect poverty. Those are two key programs. One supports earnings. The other one puts food on the table. And without these two programs, poverty would be a lot higher. So in Wisconsin, actually, poverty is a little lower than the national average. We're doing a little bit better. But we're not doing that much better. So you said something like 13% before. I think it's about 11% according to the Wisconsin Poverty Report. A little bit higher for children. And the most interesting thing, I think, in this year's Wisconsin Poverty Report was, despite, you know, our low unemployment rate and all this other design that's going on, market income poverty, which is driven by earnings, did not fall in Wisconsin, and overall poverty actually increased. So you have to ask yourself, well, how could that be in, you know, in this strong economy that we have? Well, that's an interesting question, and I can say more about it if you'd like.
Yeah, why would that be? Improving economy, but still this chronic poverty problem.
Well, there are still a lot of people out there working at very low wages. The Wisconsin minimum wage is $7.35, and it hasn't budged for over 10 years. People, single parents, for instance, get part-time jobs with hours that vary all over the place. Somebody told me, well, you can get $13 an hour at any Quick Trip in Wisconsin. Well, you have to work 11 to 7. Or 3 to 11 a Quick Trip to do that, and it's hard to do that raising kids and without transportation and so forth. So most poor people who are able are actually working. They're just not earning enough to get out of poverty. They get help from SNAP or food share, which helps feed their families, and they get a bonus every year from refundable tax credits because they don't earn enough to support their families. You can't support a family of three even on a job that's $10 an hour, particularly if you can only work part-time.
Do you think that's a misconception about a lot of public assistance programs? I think the assumption might be these are people who don't have work at all. A fair amount of them, it sounds like you're saying, are people with lower-paying jobs also receiving, say, food aid or the earned income tax credit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are very few people. I mean, first of all, the idea of welfare, we wiped that out with Tommy Thompson and W-2. In the mid-1990s, we don't have people staying home getting checks anymore. There are time limits. We don't spend anything on that program. One of the good things is we used to spend money on cash in those programs, and now we use some of it to pay for the state earned income tax credit, and we use some of it to pay for supplement our child care funds. But the child care funds aren't enough to deal with the problems we're going to face if we start trying to force more people who are on these programs to work more. So, for instance, next October, the governor plans, with a waiver from the USDA, plans to force mothers whose youngest child is of school age, in other words, supposedly they're in school some of the time, to work 30 hours a week to keep their benefits. Now, that's a lot of work, and so you have to ask, well, are there any support services? Do you have before and after school care? I mean, the idea that you drop your kid off at school in the morning at 8:30, get to work by 9, and be done by 3 and come back and pick up the baby, that just doesn't work for single parents and low-income families. It just doesn't. Their jobs are more scattered. They're more part-time. You'd at least have to have before and after school care. Then you'd have to have good child care in the summer, too. And I don't see the support services we need in terms of transportation or child care. And I certainly do not see a higher minimum wage, all of which would help make the program work.
We're talking to Tim Smeeting right now. He's a professor and poverty researcher at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about a recent report from the White House that declared the Johnson-era war on poverty to be effectively over. But some researchers, including our guest, disagree with the claim that poverty has been mostly eradicated in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this statement, this report from the White House? What do you think it could mean for social programs like food assistance, for example? Do you think it's time to rework these programs? Is this you? Are you one of the people our guest is talking about working in a lower paid job, raising a family? What do things like the earned income tax credit, food assistance mean for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about a recent report from the White House that said that the war on poverty is largely over and that it's time to rework social programs. Timothy Smeeting is with us, the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this report from the White House? Do you see poverty in your own community, in your own backyard? What programs do you think the government should have? What do you think of the idea of work requirements for people receiving food assistance and other government help programs? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. This is just so disturbing. First of all, it's not a war, for God's sakes. And second of all, in Appleton, they did their homeless count just a couple of nights ago, their quarterly homeless count, and the numbers are the highest it's ever been. So for the government, our federal government, to say that there is poverty has been eradicated, I mean, what planet are they living on? It's just so disturbing, because all this is just another way for them to tell people that they need to cut, you know, these so-called entitlements. And we can give $5.2 billion tax credits to Foxconn, but we can't help our own homeless and poor people. That's just so disturbing to me. I can't even believe it.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. Tim, for homeless people, maybe the people in the worst situations of poverty, what kind of things could we do that we aren't doing? What kind of things are working in some places?
Well, there's some pretty good programs in Madison, actually, and it's just been taking off. And in Minneapolis, it's called Homes First. In other words, housing first. You give somebody a house, and then you work with them on their larger issues, which they almost all have. There are a lot of people now, especially in the summer, living in their cars with their families. That's become a new way to live, according to Governing Magazine and the National Governors Association. So we have problems. I mean, housing is not as expensive in Wisconsin as you'd expect, but incomes are still too low to afford it in many different places. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you lose a paycheck or something happens, somebody gets sick, the car breaks down, you can end up not being able to afford your rent and be evicted, and you'll end up in bad straits. As my former student, now famous, Matt Desmond, wrote in his book Evicted about Milwaukee, which is, you know, set off a whole national interest in housing for the poor and the problems of eviction and trying to prevent people from being evicted.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Melinda in Black River Falls. Melinda, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I guess I'm trying to not take offense, because I'm one of those single mothers that he's claiming is impossible to be able to get on their feet and can't juggle everything. I went back to school as an adult with four kids on my own, supported myself, went to work, went to school, and you have to actually want and be willing to do it. I was on daycare assistance for literally 2 months, 3 months to get my certification and to be able to do my internship. Other than that, I've had to pay my way and do that way, and it's out there. There's tons of programs out there. There's tons of ways to get around and help. You have to be willing to actually put the work in to be able to motivate and to be able to get ahead.
Melinda, thanks for the call. Tim, Melinda saying she can do it, other people can do it too.
God bless you, Melinda. I'm glad you were able to do it. Others aren't quite so lucky. Now, please get me right here. The answer to poverty is a good job that pays enough to support your family. Getting a degree or getting a certification in as a medical technician, for instance, and getting a good job in that field is exactly where we need to go. But it's harder for some people to get there than for others. And that's my problem. Now, a lot of people have good family support while they're doing it. Belinda, who was watching your four kids while you're off at school and trying to do all that other stuff? You had a, I'm hoping that you had some sort of support to do it.
Melinda dropped off the line there. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I applaud Melinda. People can do it, and people have done it, and people are doing it every day. But sometimes it's harder if you're stuck in downtown Milwaukee, and the jobs are all out in the periphery, and you don't have a car that's reliable, or you don't have reliable childcare, or you did not do well in high school and didn't graduate from high school. Let's say you had your first child early on before you finished schooling. Well, then it's really hard to find a job that pays enough and to catch on. Your resume doesn't look very good. You don't have good work support and so forth. Now, we'd like to figure out what we could do to help those people, to help them get more education and training. We like employers who are willing to stand up and say, I need workers, I'll give this person a chance, and help them get to work and give them the child care and so forth. If we do that, I think we can solve the problem. But just pushing them off without any help, sending them to a class to learn how to put together a resume for 2 weeks, has been shown to be ineffective. The thing about it, and this is what really frosts me right now, is the governor vetoed any attempt to evaluate what we do next year. So in other words, we're going to do this program. A few people will rise above and get lucky and find jobs and put it together and make it, and a whole lot more won't. But we're not going to keep any data on that. We're not going to keep do any evaluation of how well the program worked and what happened to the people who succeeded in the program and those who failed in the program. That's ridiculous. All public policy, all government, you need to evaluate what it is you're doing. You need to be able with a straight face to say whether this thing worked or not. What happened? How many people earned their way off the program? How many people got jobs but still needed food share? How many people got dropped from the rolls because they couldn't find 30 hours a week of work? Those are important questions, and we need to know that. And to veto a bill that would evaluate that is ridiculous. But it's been vetoed last time. There's another chance this year to pass the bill to evaluate what's going on with these workfare efforts of ours. How much does it cost? How many people do we get into good, well-paying jobs? How many people fall by the wayside and lose, you know, the ability to feed their families? Those are questions that everyone ought to know. They should be answered. And so far, there's been no attempt to figure out how to answer it.
Melinda, thanks for sharing your story at 800-642-1234, talking about poverty in Wisconsin and around the country. We have Tim Smeeting with us from UW-Madison. Back to your calls. Mary is on the line in Pewaukee. Mary, hi.
Oh, hi. Yes. Well, thank you and your guests for the show. I hate to assume anything, but I believe that the last caller, you know, good for her, but I believe she was probably white. At least she sounded so. I don't think some people realize the difference when you are of color, which I am not. We have white privilege. The same situation for one family and as a white privileged woman, and I get it too. A woman also is a minority, but life is different. So that's all, the only point I wanted to make on that. And great for her. Some people can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but some people don't even have the boots.
Mary, thanks for the call. Tim, can you talk about the racial breakdown of poverty in Wisconsin?
Very, very well said. Very well said. Race is certainly a matter. The black unemployment rate in our state is 9%, even if the overall one is just under 3. Race matters. The only area in the only county in our state which had a poverty rate which is significantly above the state average was Milwaukee County. And if you go inside Milwaukee County, you can find poverty rates even after all these programs of 40 and 50% in the very black middle of the city, and poverty rates of 3-4% in Whitefish Bay, Cedarburg, Brown Deer, in the same county. You don't have to go to Waukesha. You don't have to even go to Washington, Ozaukee, or Jefferson. It's right there. So race is a big issue. And in this fall, Poverty Matters will be held in September 26th and 7th, I think, in Milwaukee. And I'll have a new addendum to the Wisconsin Poverty Report that focuses explicitly on the role of race in poverty in our state. Race and ethnicity, we'll be looking at Latinos, too. This will be the first time we've done that. But it's clear that's where the real problem is. We need to find ways to help African-American families with kids in Milwaukee find jobs and have a fair chance. We need to find a way to take those who've done their job, paid their debt to society, who've been incarcerated, and are black. By the way, our African-American male incarceration rate in our state is the second highest in the country. Okay, so we have a serious issue there. We need to get people out of the prison cycle, prison off, back again, into jobs and into a chance to grow and move ahead. Now, there are people trying to do that in Madison, like Johnny Hunter, who runs Underground Butcher. He and others have started a bakery and training and food services to help those who were formerly incarcerated break the cycle of crime and get a decent job. And God bless them. We need more and more and more efforts like that. And do you know that the probability of an African-American man with less than a high school education, by age 30, about 65% of them have been incarcerated? So you have some tie-up with the law, which means some mark on your record and something that puts you at the bottom of all the hiring queues and so forth. And we have to work directly on the problem of race and poverty, especially in Milwaukee, but in the rest of the state, too.
Time for one more quick call. Teresa is with us in Delavan. Teresa, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know you have a few minutes, but I want to applaud the lady that just called and admitted to being privileged. It's a lot of privileged people that does not admit that, so I commend her. But I am African-American, calling from Delavan, and I raised my son, and I did it, but I had help. Unfortunately, a lot of blacks in society today does not have the help that I have had from my family, and it falls under poverty and socioeconomic statuses. So thanks for bringing this whole thing up. I wish I had more time to talk.
Teresa, thanks for calling, and Teresa will have the last word. And Tim, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Robin, and thank the callers. I think it was a very good set of callers with really good questions and points to make, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thank you. That's Tim Smeeting, Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He joins us today to talk about a recent report from the White House declaring the effective end of the war on poverty. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we start our series of interviews with candidates in the primary campaign for governor of Wisconsin. A guest tells us why we're seeing so many wildfires in the western United States this year. And the author of the book Respecting Animals says we need to rethink our relationship with animals in the wild, as pets, and in our food system. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.